Hillary D. from Lillian, Alabama.
Well, I wasn't sure I was ever going to get up here. The program says 8:30 till 10 o'clock, and it's already after 9, about 9:10. So I don't know what's going to happen. We'll see. My name is Hillary Draper, and I'm an alcoholic. Mercy, mercy, mercy. I want to be sure I mind my manners. I want to thank anybody who had anything to do with getting me out here. I remember 1977, I think we went to Santa Rosa, if I'm not mistaken. And I had to come on a night flight. I got to San Francisco at 5 a.m. The first plane to go up to Santa Rosa, which was a little bitty thing, left at 8. I sat there for 3 hours, and I got on that little bitty airplane. We took off. The man said, "Don't get excited. We'll go out over the ocean, but we'll turn around and come back." So we were out over the ocean, and I'm looking. I was sitting by a window. And the hostess came by, a little bitty plane, maybe 20 seats. I'm not sure there's even 20. And I said to the lady, I said, "I believe that Moda is on fire." She says, "Oh, no, no, no." She looked out and she says, "Oh, my God." Shot up to the pilot to tell him, and he put it out. And then he says, "We could go on to Santa Rosa on one engine," but he says, "We're not going to do that. We'll go back to San Francisco and get another airplane." Oh. So as we came back to San Francisco, he says, "Now don't anybody get excited, because when we land, that engine may catch on fire again." But he says, "We've got fire engines all out there, and the runway is covered with the, what do they cover with that soot, that stuff, foam," and says, "We're all going to be safe." Well, we landed, and I'm telling you, we got out. And they were complimenting everybody how brave they were, and how the lady sitting in the seat to me says, "Would you just please get me to a bathroom?" Thanks be to God, we had no experiences like that getting to San Jose. I'm reading from the big book. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. But not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. That's page 151 in the big book. And what I'm supposed to do this evening is to stand up here and tell you what happened to me to bring me to face the four hideous horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, and to tell you how this glorious program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and God, whom I choose to call Higher Power, I don't think that's funny, has turned my terror into delight, my bewilderment into certainty, my frustration into completion, and my despair into hope. I was born at a very early age in a good Christian home. I've heard so many alcoholics say that, and I'm not sure it's anywhere as to rare children anymore. But at any rate, I was, and it was a Catholic home in Mobile, Alabama. And I cannot tell you when I had my first drink. It was always there. It was just part of living, period. The good times. We didn't drink every day. It was the Depression. But when company was there, it was always drinks. Always. And I came from a great big relationship. I had five aunts and one adopted aunt, and they were all built like ice cream cones. You know that type lady? I got real tickled. I went to watch that Susie the South, and Susie reminded me a great deal of one of my aunts. Not that she was a drinker, but the way she was built. And they had their own population explosion. The last time I counted, I think I had 60 first cousins running around in Mobile. But there was one uncle, call him Harry, who was always the leader of the pack and who was always in charge whenever that tribe got together for weddings or funerals or whatever. And Harry was always taking one more drink to steady his nerves. And then he'd get so steady he couldn't move. And the other uncles would have to carry him home. But watch this. I remember my mother saying to us, now y'all saw Uncle Harry last night. If you find out that drinking does that to you, you just don't drink. But you saw all the rest of your uncles and aunts, perfect ladies and gentlemen. So if it could be said of anybody that he had an education how to drink like a gentleman, it should have been me. It was always there, period. Always. And I cannot remember when I had my first drink. You know, they'd leave a little beer in the bottom of the glass and give it to you to finish it off. They'd add a little cold water to a little bit of the wine, and man, you could be just like the big people. Oh, Lord. My father was dead before I was 4 years old, and I did not know until I got to you all that I resented the hell out of God for taking my father. I really did. And it wasn't until I got to you all that I realized how resentful, I think the chief resentment of my life was the fact that I didn't have a daddy. Now, a lot of people lose a father for whatever reason. They don't make a federal case out of it, but people would say, poor little boy, he doesn't have a daddy. And I'd say, yeah, poor little boy, I don't have a daddy. You know? Oh, Lord. And, you know, I didn't know the word until very lately, but I grew up a dysfunctional child. I'll tell you what I was like. I was the kind of kid that when they were choosing up sides to play ball, they'd say, if you take him, we'll give you two others. That's true. That's true. A mess, that's all there was to it. By the time I was 15, my mother, God rest her soul, Mom, I have to tell you that the male image in my life was my grandfather, who was an excellent man, superb, but he was an old gentleman. He didn't play baseball. He didn't, you know, that was beyond him. But marvelous man, and I'm grateful for his presence in my life. But my mother realized that I needed more men in my education, and so when I was 15 years old, she sold me up the river to the tender mercies of the Benedictine monks at Coleman, and I never got away. I was not a happy camper. Oh, Lord, have mercy on me when I think about those years. I had never learned the things that ordinary boys learn when they're growing up. The only athletic things I knew how to do, I could play handball and I could swim. But as for the rest of it, And but they expected you at St. Bernard in those years to go out for sports. And I was in the junior study hall, and Father Luke, God rest his soul, who remained a friend of mine until he died just recently. Father Luke was the coach of the junior basketball team. He says, go out for basketball. So I go out for basketball. Well, you know, when they cut the team, he called me. He says, you didn't make the team, but if you buy your own uniform, you can stay out. So I bought my own uniform. I stayed out. He never let me in but one game. I think we were ahead 30 points. And he said, go ahead. I don't even know whether I played forward or guard. I don't know what. But I know they threw me the ball, and I ran down the wrong way and scored 2 points for the other team. He was a priest. I never heard such language in my life. Anyhow, it gives you an idea, you know. I wasn't well adjusted. That's all there was to it. I was a good student, and I came to love everything about Cullman and the monks. I thought they were wonderful, wonderful people. On top of that, I came to know some of the local families in town. I think that's the only reason I was able to stay. There was one family there; their kid was in our class. It was what we called day dogs. You know, they went and came. And she took me under her wing, a wonderful, wonderful woman. And I think she recognized that I was the most homesick 15-year-old kid you ever saw. I declare. But let me tell you what I discovered at 15 years old. I found out that all the housewives of Cullman, worthy of that name, knew how to squeeze the grape and make that German-type grape juice. Only they did it with Cullman County strawberries. And if you all haven't tasted Cullman County strawberry wine before you got into AA, it's just too late. You're going to have to wait till you get to heaven. The most glorious color of red I've ever seen in my life. When you took the cork out of the bottle, you could smell it in the next block. And it kicked like the proverbial Missouri mule. Oh, mercy. And you weren't in any trouble. You were in somebody's home, a small glass of homemade wine, a piece of cake. It was wonderful. In 41, I decided I wanted to become a monk. They said I could try. June the 1st, 1941. How long is that? 50-something years. Lord have mercy. How come I'm not any better than I am today after that? But I got into the monastery. They said I could try. And you know what I discovered, first thing, is the monks were not about to be outdone by the housewives of Cullman. And they, too, knew how to squeeze that grape, make that German-type grape juice, and they made a little homebrew on the side. You talk about a revelation to the Gentiles. Now, the monks didn't drink every day. But on a big feast day, for an hour after Vespers, if you know the German word, Gemütlichkeit, they'd come together, sandwiches and homemade wine and homebrew, pink lemonade for the panty waists, you know. But it meant more to me than it did to them. I was always the first one there and the last one to leave, period. I was always looking, when's the next time this is going to happen, you know? Oh, Lord. And by that time I was 18 years old, you know. And look at my drinking pattern. From the time I was 18 years old, I always drank as much as I could, as long as I could, as long as there's anything else to drink or I could find it. The only two things that ever made me quit drinking from the time I was 18 was either I was too sick to drink it or there was nothing left to drink. And that's not normal drinking. And Christmas time, 1941, a monk, young monk in the monastery, I experienced my first blackout. For fear that some of y'all don't know what that is, I'm going to explain it. You drink and drink and drink and drink, and the body, to save its own life, short-circuits some of the systems. You lose consciousness, you fall under the table, and there you stay until the next morning, until you crawl out. That's not blacking out. That's passing out. And I've passed out, too. But in blacking out, you drink and drink and drink. And again, the body, to save its own life, short-circuits some of the systems, But this time, you go into, quote, temporary amnesia, unquote. You continue to function, quote, normally, quote, but you don't remember it. And for all you Al-Anons, when you say to your espouse, where were you last night? He says, I don't remember. And he says, you lying. And you say to him, who were you with last night? He says, I don't remember. She says, you're lying again. He may not be lying at all. He may not have the slightest idea of where he was, who he was with, or where the money went. Now, and there I am at Christmas in the monastery. You know, you don't join monasteries to become drunks. You join monasteries as a kind of special Christian witness. And there I am, Christmas. It was before Christmas. We were having a party. And the last thing I remember, it was 9 o'clock, I think, and the party was over at 11. We had to get up early. But there's 2 hours, I don't remember a thing. The next morning when I wake up, I would think, ooh, that's funny. I wonder what happened last night. And I began to slip around and try to find out what did happen. And they told me, apparently, nothing. I stayed till the last shot was fired, as usual, helped the old fathers to their rooms, went to chapel, said my prayers after they washed the dishes, went to bed. But there is 2 hours or a little bit more out of my life that I have absolutely no remembrance of, and I don't remember it to this day what happened. Being, however, an intelligent collegian, I had to account for that phenomenon. And after I considered it with Aristotelian Thomistic philosophical principles, I came to the conclusion that it was the cheese. Now, you're laughing. But you see, that's the alcoholic people. You know? Everybody knows he's an alcoholic. His wife knows it. His kids know it. His boss knows it. His relatives know it. His dog knows it. Have you ever seen a dog living in an alcoholic home? Man, he can smell it on the old man's breath, and he goes under the bed, and he stays there. Cats are dumber. They get kicked around. And the reason I told you that story is because if you experience what I just described, that's almost a Satan sign that you got it. It's almost a Satan sign that you've crossed that invisible line between controlled and uncontrolled drinking. And I suggest to you Al-Anon folks that if you've experienced what I described, you might ought to move your letter over to the other side of the room. But there I am, 18 years old in a monastery, a novice, and I've crossed that invisible line. And I am an alcoholic. I often wonder if somebody could have said to me, if I could have opened up and talked to them, which I wouldn't, but if I could have, they would have said to me, hey, kid, what you've described is a Satan sign that you're not going to be able to handle alcohol. You're just one of those people that are not going to be able to handle it. Could I have been spared the agony that was to come? I don't know. It's water over the dam, under the bridge. Let it go, period. Live in the now. I heard that somewhere. Today I heard it. But there I am. I found out, first of all, I didn't know what alcoholism was. I knew what drunkenness was, but I didn't know that alcoholism was a disease. I had to get into this program to read the big book and find it out. To find out that it's progressive, that it's a mental obsession tied up with a physical compulsion to drink. Yeah. And that if you give me the first drink, it sets up that craving. And, brother, it's Katie bar the door. We're off and running again. Period. Lord have mercy. I've come to know in this program that it is a fatal disease. And that if I am an alcoholic, there are only three ends to which this disease will progress. If I keep on drinking alcoholically, number one, I'll end up dead drunk, in the literal meaning of those two words. I'll end up in what is euphemistically called custodial care. And in Alabama, that means you go to Tuscaloosa, not to the university, but to the other And third, you quit. And for me, the horrible thing that I came to realize with those four terrible horsemen of bewilderment, frustration, despair, that when I came to the realization that I wanted to and had to quit, I discovered to my horror that I could not. I could not. I was ordained as a priest in 1947. That's almost, it is 47 years ago. Lord have mercy. 47 years ago. And if there had been any overt signs that Hillary Draper was an alcoholic, believe me, Bishop Tulin would not have called me to orders. The Catholic Church has got enough trouble without ordaining drunk monks. And the opportunities of drinking are much more frequent as a priest. I'm not going to tell you how in a Benedictine monastery I got my booze. That's none of your business. A real alcoholic can get it no matter where he's locked up. But be that as it may, we were running a very fancy prep school in those years, and I was the associate principal, and the opportunities for drinking were much more frequent. I didn't drink every day, but my pattern was once I started, I didn't quit. I guess I was a periodic binge drinker, if you want to classify it. I don't know. But at any rate, what happened to me was that I began to develop these horrible personality clashes with the boss. Now, you can develop personality clashes with the boss, and they can be reconciled if there's good will on both sides. But if alcohol's in the picture, you ain't going to reconcile nothing. Period. And alcohol was in my picture. I'm sure the boss at that time knew that I was drinking, but he didn't say one word to me about it. If he had, I'd have been on him like a bee on a bulldog. I'd have said, what you talking about? I'm teaching five classes a day. I'm running the band. I'm doing all this. I'm the associate assistant principal. Why don't you get on some of these bums over here that are not doing a blessed thing? And even if I am drinking too much, I'm not, listen to this, I'm not hugging anybody but myself. We heard about that this weekend, didn't we? What I get is a geographical cure removal before I know what that is. I was attending the University of Alabama in pursuit of an elusive degree in the summertime, and I got this letter. And it said, Dear Father Hillary, we need Father Timothy to come home from Barberville, Kentucky, to teach philosophy. We want you to go up there and take his place in the mountains of Kentucky. Well, I'd had a terrible struggle in my youth trying to decide what kind of priest I wanted to be. And I wanted to be a Benedictine. That's a monk who lives in the monastery. And here I get this letter to go to Barberville, Kentucky. I went to Father Malachy, who's dead, and he was in this program, and I said, Malachy, look at this letter. And he read the letter, and he began to laugh. I said, will you stop laughing? Nothing laughing about this at all. I said, where in the Lord's name is Barberville, Kentucky? He says, well, you go to hell, turn left, and walk 3 miles. And he was wrong. It was only 2 miles. Oh, Lord, have mercy on my poor soul. I guess I ought to tell you about this fan. It might bother some of you delicate people. But you see, when I was drinking, I used to have the hot flashes and the shakes. Notice, I don't shake anymore. But I still have the hot flashes. And AA has told me, do something about it. So if this fan bothers you, that's your problem. But let me tell you, I went to Barberville. You talk about resentments. I had resentments so big that I didn't even go, and you're supposed to, when you get something like that, go to the abbot and ask for his blessing before you leave. I said to myself, blessing, messing, I'm not about to even talk to him. I packed my bag and I left for the mountains of Kentucky, period. And, man, I got to Barberville. Lord have mercy. I have to tell you, the first morning I was there, Father Timothy was still there. We had said Mass. And he said, you take your meals over at Aunt Sally Coon's house. That's right across the field. It's your house, and Uncle Albert and Aunt Sally are renting it. Uncle Albert is a Catholic, but Aunt Sally belongs to the Lottie Moon Circle. She's a First Class Baptist. But when you're here, you're riding the circuits. Whenever you're here, they feed you. So let's go have breakfast. Well, we go across the field to breakfast, and I am introduced to Aunt Sally Coon. Did any of y'all remember Mammy Yoakum in the funny papers? Well, that was the spitting image of Aunt Sally Coon, even with the pipe and the snuff. And she wasn't happy over the new priest. She'd got the old one broken in nicely. Oh. It was a four-room cabin. We were in the kitchen. Uncle Albert was a lovely man, retired miner in his 60s, beautiful man. Timothy was there. I was over here. Uncle Albert's son was a state trooper in his 30s. And he's sitting there, and all he had on was a pair of shorts. And his two boys, 18, 17, that's all they was had on. And conversation was difficult. Sitting in front of me was a great big tumbler, water tumbler, had the cool and nice looking, and I picked it up and took two great big swallows. Well, you all have seen the atomic bomb blasts. I couldn't see, I couldn't hear, the hair on the back of my neck stood straight up. I'm convinced if I hadn't been an alcoholic, I would have screamed bloody murder, but I don't. I just hang on tight till the tremors pass. I'm telling you the truth. I'm not making this up. And when I can see again, Timothy's got one, Uncle Albert's got one, the troopers got one, the kids don't. Well, after that breakfast, Timothy and I are stepping high over the weeds going back to the church. And I said to him, Timothy, in the Lord's holy name, what was in that water glass? He said, moonshine, 120 proof. I said, for breakfast? He said, anytime you can get it. What a place to send a budding alcoholic. And I bloomed, you know. It was there that I first met Alcoholics Anonymous. Before he left to go back to Alabama, he said to me, you know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, yeah, they're a group that try to help these poor people who drink too much. He said, yes. He said, well, they've just formed a small group in this little town. Bobbleville had about, 2,000 people, I reckon, at that time. And he says, there's none of the members of your church belong, but he says, they're the spouses of some of your members, and I've been going down to try to help them, and maybe you'd want. I thought, yeah, I'd be glad to go. I'll go help them. Well, they'd let me go to all the open meetings, but they would not let me go to the closed meetings. And I thought to myself, if they let me go to the closed meetings, I could probably help those devils. And, you know, I often think today, they say we never say about another person, he or she is an alcoholic. You have to say that about yourself. But if he walks like a duck, he quacks like a duck, he smells like a duck, he looks like a duck, most likely he's a duck. And I often wonder in the closed meetings, if the subject wasn't, what are we going to do with that young priest at the end of Pine Street who walks like a duck, smells like a duck, and doesn't know he's a duck? I'll tell you what they did. Oh, Lord, I hate to tell you. That's way, way back. I wasn't 5 years a priest, so that had to be back in the 1950s. There was a conference like this. Nothing was this big at Cumberland Falls in Kentucky, southeastern Kentucky. And it was an AA convention. And they invited me to speak to the conference as a friend. And in my arrogance and pride, I accepted that invitation. And on a Sunday morning, I was a Sunday morning speaker, Jack. And I told those people that I didn't need their program, but that I liked them so much that if I ever needed their program, I'd be glad to be associated with them. You know, I'll never know what they had to say to the speaker selection committee. Well, needless to say, I did not get to Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. I was recalled to the college. I was dean, academic dean, but my drinking was progressing. And I didn't have to drink every day, but I had to have it where I could shake it. Look at the frog eyes. You know, y'all look at the frog eyes? You didn't know whiskey had frog eyes on it? Lord, y'all ignorant. anyhow, I'd have it in the closet, you know. And I didn't have to drink every day, but once I started, man, I was off and running, you know. Oh, Lord. And what happens is, about 2 years later, I get another geographical cure removal. This time, the boss is right near. We're not talking to one another. We live in the same building. We're not talking to one. I get another letter. It says, go to the Delta of the Mississippi, to a place called Shaw, as pastor. Now, if you all think you know the South, you think the Delta is in southwest Louisiana. It's not. The Delta begins in the lobby of the Peabody Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. And it goes down the river, 40 miles on the Mississippi side, 20 miles on the Arkansas side, and you come to Yazoo City. And if you haven't lived in that part of the South, you don't know what the South is all about. The people there do not know that the Civil War was lost. They do not know that it was even fought and couldn't care less. You talk about drinking as a way of life. Oh, my Lord. I'm going to tell you how bad it was. I went to that parish. It was 99.9% Italian and 0.3% Cajun. And that was the only parish I ever went to. I'll tell you, this fine gentleman came to see me, a great Italian, and I had a terrible toothache. I was waiting to go to the dentist, and finally I said, Floriano, I have to go to the dentist. If there's nothing else to say. Oh, he said, no. He said, I'm ready to go. I was waiting for you to offer me a drink. Did you ever get offered a drink at a priest's house? That was the custom there. If you went to make a pastoral call, they always offered you a drink before you left. And they expected you to offer them a drink before they left your house. Well, that was just lovely with me. I couldn't imagine being in a finer place, you know. Oh, Lord, have mercy. But you see, it's a progressive disease. And I know today that this is a disease, we heard it in the afternoon, too. It's a disease which attacks us totally and completely. We come apart. We come apart spiritually and emotionally, mentally, and finally physically. We come across apart in that order. And I was becoming apart spiritually. I was a priest. I should have known. I didn't want what I was becoming, you know. I would go to confession, and the priest would say to me, well, hey, you got to pray more. You got to pray more. Lord, I prayed till I was blue in the face. But again, we heard it this conference. In the last stages of my alcoholism, the only prayer I knew to say was, dear God, get me out of this one, and I'll never do it again. And he'd get me out of it, and I'd do it again. But I always say it was going to be different this time. It was always different. It was always worse. Oh, Lord. And by this time, you know, you can't hide alcoholism. You think you're a closet drinker. Oh, Lord, have mercy. You know, they'll find it out. And they were beginning to talk ugly about me in that parish, you know. They don't like drunken priests. They don't like them at all. And it was horrible. At any rate, we had a new boss at Coleman. And he was coming over to Texas, to Dallas, to do some business. And he wrote and said he was going to spend the night with me in Mississippi. And I thought, oh, Lord, somebody's been snitching. I didn't know him. He was brand new. He was a Yankee. Come down to save us from our sins. Lord have mercy. He saved me, and today he's still alive, and I just love him to death. But they came, and they spent the night. Well, man, I had an Italian supper that wouldn't quit. We had antipasta with drinks. We had antipasta with drinks. We had pasta with drinks. We had three kinds of wine at the table. We had drinks after dinner. I didn't touch a thing. Not a blessed thing. Well, the boss went to bed, and his secretary was with him, and I said, what's the boss want down here? Oh, he said, didn't he talk to you? I said, well, no more than you heard at the table. Oh, he said, well, you've been nominated the 7th president of St. Bernard College. And he's the chancellor and the chairman of the board of trustees. And he said before he acted on the nomination, he thought he'd better come down here and interview you. And he told me when he was going to bed that he was well satisfied. And And would you believe I got the nomination as president of the college? Now, you talk about the insanity of this problem, of this disease. You know, with my track record and people beginning to talk ugly about me, a sane person would have said, thank you kindly, but I cannot handle that job. What does the alcoholic, the towering ego of the alcoholic say? Certainly I'll take that job. You don't think they'd be offering it to a drunk? And they gave me a glorious send-off. I know today they were saying, thank God he's gone. And I have to tell you that because of this program, I've been able to go back to Mississippi and make amends and hold up my head. And I am so grateful for that. But I came home and was president of the college. Oh, Lord, have mercy. And everything that hadn't already happened to me that happens to alcoholics happened in those 3 years. You wouldn't believe, you know. Here I am. Oh, Lord, you... I wake up one morning, and I'm... It's early. I always wake up early. And I think, where am I? How did I get here? There's bars on the window. There's no mattress on this bed. And when I come to, I realize I'm in jail. That's where I am. And I don't know how I got there, and I don't know what jail it is. I get up to the window and try to figure out where is it. And the way those people built that jail, I could not tell if I was in Mobile, New Orleans, Birmingham, Nashville, Chattanooga, or Rome, Italy. And I have to tell you, I don't know, it may be different over here in California. Y'all are so progressive. But down there in Alabama, in the small towns, there's always somebody who is either Mr. or Mrs. Catholic Church. And whatever happens, that person is always called up and, you know, what do we do? Well, the man in charge of the Catholic Church in that little town was called Mr. Frank. And at midnight or after, they call up Mr. Frank and they say, Mr. Frank, we got a priest in the pokey down here, drunk and disorderly. DUI. And Frank says, well, where you got him? Says, we got him in the jail. That's where we got him. Says, what's his name? Says, well, his driver's license says Hillary. And Mr. Frank says, leave him there. I'll get him in the morning. And the reason I tell you that is when some of you had that experience, when they came to get me out of the jail and take me down to the sergeant's desk, you know, I would rather have seen Pope John Paul II than to have seen Mr. Frank. Because guess who Mr. Frank was? He was the late chairman of the bus board of trustees of the Hotshot College, of which I was the president. And you know, cunning, baffling, and powerful. That man is a great man, wonderful man. He's dead and gone now, and I was able to make... He should have said, hey, Father Hillary, we're going to have to do something about this. But no, I conned him. I said, oh, Frank, I was at the country club, and I just got too much cheese. And he bought it. And I ran on for another year and a half. But the day came. The day came when the president was supposed to make a State of the Union message to all the important people in that college community, to the 45 monks who taught the classes, to the lay faculty, to the Student Government Association, to the lay board of trustees, anybody who was anybody, and 200 and some people. They all were at dinner, and the president, me, to make a speech after that dinner. And I made the speech. The only thing is that the Lord is my witness. The last thing I remember that day was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was taking one more drink to steady my nerves. And I went into a blackout, and I delivered that speech in the blackout. And when I tell you that, I can begin to sweat, because I can have some idea what it must have been like for those 200 lovely people to sit there and watch and listen to the obviously drunken Catholic priest, president of the college. That was it. I didn't know it, but that was my bottom. I noticed the next morning when I came to that the atmosphere on the campus was a little cool. A few days later, I'm throwing dust. You know how we do as alcoholics? Don't let them see what's really happening. And I'm going into the boss's office, the chancellor's office, throwing that dust, and he listens to me. And then he says, sit down, Father Hillary. I want to say something to you. We didn't even know the word intervention. That's way back in... I didn't tell you my sobriety date. It's January the 14th, 1968. And this was in December that he did this intervention. And what he said to me, ooh, it was awful. He said, we are not putting up with your drunken behavior any longer. We have had a meeting of the Board of Trustees. By that time, I was so sly, I got myself elected to the Board of Trustees. I said, you didn't inform me. He said, no, but we had a quorum. And I said, mean, bold, brassy, what was on the agenda? He says, only one thing, your resignation. And I said, it's still nasty. When is it effective? Next June, the end of the school year? He looks at me with all the compassion in his eyes, and he says, no, it's effective now. We've drawn it up, signed here. And he proceeded to read me the riot act in six gorgeous technicolor scenes. He told me that I had dragged my own family name through the mud of drunkenness, that I had disgraced the priesthood, that I had outraged the monks in that monastery, that I was a scandal to all the lay people, and that they had no intention of putting up with me any longer. Either I could go somewheres and get some help with my drinking problem. He doesn't even know the word alcoholism. Or he would help me get a job at any college in the country because I was a good teacher. But I could not stay there. They were not putting up for it. I do not know to this day what let me say yes. I would go anywheres and do anything to try to get some help with my drinking problem. I'm convinced today that it was the prayers of all the Al-Anon people who loved me so desperately, who knew nothing to do for me but pray. That's why I love Al-Anon today as much as I do AA. And I said, yes, I would go anywhere and do anything. Well, the old man was from Minnesota, and he knew of a place called Hazelden who had a reputation for doing something good to people who were bad to drink. And I got sent to Hazelden in December. Have any of y'all been up there in January? Oh, Lord. No wonder they drink. Oh. I've never been so cold in all of my life. I couldn't even function. You know, go to the bathroom. It was terrible. And there I was, all alone. Oh, Lord, Lord, Lord. And I didn't know what they did to you in an alcoholic treatment center. I didn't know whether they blew through your ears, whether they turned your head around, whether they stuffed something up inside you. I didn't know. There are treatment centers that I call gold-plated souse traps that'll dry you out, introduce you to the pills, and turn you loose to run again. But at Hazelden, all they did was the 12 steps program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had three meetings a day where somebody stood up and talked about one of the steps. And then we had a few private meetings where they tried to get you to face yourself, you know. Oh, Lord have mercy. The first morning I was there, I went down to the counselor. That's not true. They took me down to the counselor. And first thing he said to me, he says, now, Father Hillary, we're not going to call you Father anymore because you ain't nothing but a goddamn drunk. Oh, I was so outraged. I was going to call up the boss in Alabama and says, you know, you sent me up here with blasphemers as well as profaners. He said, you don't have any right to wear that Roman collar. You're not in good standing in the priesthood. We're not going to call you Father. That's all there is to it. And at that time, it was a 3 weeks program, and they said, now don't plan on 3 weeks for this program. I said, of course not. I reckon I'll get it in two. Oh, no. He says, we find for doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, undertakers, pharmacists, college professors, priests, nuns, it takes 3 and 4 times as long to get this simple program. And I said, why? They said, because you all keep up such a dreadful front. It takes a long time to get behind there and find out where the real Hillary's living. And they were right. I went up there January the 14th. I stayed all during Lent. That's 40 days. I stayed all during the Easter time. That's another 40 days. May came and went, and I was still there. You see, at that time when he told me that, they gave me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not true. They sold it to me. And they told me to read it. And I went back to my room, and I looked inside to see if it was imprimatur by a Catholic bishop, and it is not. And I said, I'll bet this is good old Baptist literature printed in Nashville, Tennessee. And I'll be damned if I'm going to get brainwashed reading that. And I wouldn't read it. No. Now, at the same time, they sold me the 24-hour-a-day book. You know, that's not conference-approved, but y'all know it. You know, they sold me that. I loved it. It wasn't approved by a Catholic bishop, but I was crazy about it. But I wouldn't read this. No. Well, after about 6 or 7 weeks, it became apparent to my cunning alcoholic brain that if I didn't take, work, or do the first 5 steps of this program, I was going to be in Hazelden until Gabriel blew his horn. And I decided I didn't want to stay that long. So one night, now, a lot of it had been coming through, you know, sitting in the meetings. In fact, I could have given any one of the speeches. I knew everything they said. But I sat up one night and read the first 164 pages. Couldn't wait till breakfast to get over, shot down to that counselor, and got in that room, and I said, I've got step one. My life is unmanageable. I'm powerless over alcohol. He says, you ain't got nothing. Get back. Me. He was a truck driver, I think. I said, I have got step one. My life is unmanageable. I'm powerless over alcohol. He says, you are loaded with resentments. I says, I don't resent anything. You know, I told you I resented God. I resented the abbot. I resented the bishop. I resented all the monks of Coleman. I was loaded with resentments and couldn't see it. But that was the beginning. That was the beginning. I have to tell you, I don't care. I have to tell you, I don't generally tell all of this, but there were a number of clergymen in that treatment center. I couldn't find any Baptists, and I couldn't find any Methodists. So one day I went to see one of the head knockers, and I said, now, I know that there are Episcopalian priests here, there's Catholic priests here, there's Lutheran ministers here, but I can't find any Church of Christ or Baptists. Do they know something I don't know? And I remember that man so well, sitting me down. He says, Father, there are just as many alcoholics in that group as in your group. But he said, your church will give you a second chance. Their church doesn't give them any second. I never forgot that. I never, never forgot that. So here I was. You know. Well, there was a small, he was a Christian brother, about that high. And he would go to church with us in the morning, but he wouldn't take part in anything. And one day, it was a Sunday afternoon when there wasn't much going on in the treatment center. It was knocking the door, and I said, come in. This little preacher came in about that high. He says, can I come in? I said, you already are. What do you want? He said, well, this is my second time around. I'm a golden slipper. I was in here about 4 or 5 weeks, and I went home, and I got drunk that night, and the next day they put me back in. And he said, the counselors say that I'm so down in estimation of myself that I could walk through a door without opening it, just walk under it. And said they have said in their evaluation that you're so far up that if they can't get you down, the program's not going to work for you. So they told me to come see you to see if you can get me up and I can get you down. Now you talk about cheap psychology. And I said, well, did they tell you how to do it? He says, no. Oh. Well, I said, sit down. He sat down. I said, what's your name? He says, my name is Brother. He's dead and gone. My name is Brother Joel. I said, what kind of brothers you belong to? He said, the Christian brothers. I said, my name is Father Hillary, and I belong to the Benedictines. I said, where are you? He said, we have a big college in Winona, Minnesota. He says, where are you? I said, we got a college in North Alabama. I says, what's you in the college? He says, I'm the president. And you see, I thought nobody as important as me ever came down the pike as a drunk. And here's this little creature. His college is three times as big as mine. He's got two PhDs and one of them in Greek. And all of a sudden, we found somebody to identify with. And from that day on, we began to get better. Oh, dear. He never became president of his college again. He became what they call provincial of the brothers. He appointed the president. I never became president of the college at Tubman again. I became the abbot and appointed the president in Tubman. Brother used to say that he had to come back, and I believe that, that he had to come back into the treatment center to get me. I really believe that. And I'm grateful to Almighty God. He got better and I got better. Oh, Lord. Well, they were horrible the way they did things. When they found him, you know, you had to do the step four, you had to do step five. You had to do the five steps before they let you out. That's all there was to it. So I finally got through step four. I finally got through step five. And then they said, where do we send the body? Well, I knew good and well you couldn't go back to Coleman. I said, well, he said, you've got to go back to Coleman. I said, I can't go back to Coleman. He said, why can't you go back to Coleman? I said, you know. He says, tell me. I said, well, I was drunk, and I scandalized everybody in the college community. He looked at me, and Rania, I had taken a fifth step. He says, well, you running around with women? I said, no. He said, did you embezzle the college's money? Notice the reality, the now of this program. If I had been running around with women, maybe you couldn't have sent me back to Coleman. If I had embezzled the college's money, maybe you could. He said, so you lost the job and got thrown out of the priesthood because of the disease of alcoholism. The bank president might have lost everything in Coleman for the same reason. He'd have to go back. You have to go back. That's all there is to it. And I said, all right, I'll go back. Now you convince the board of trustees to let me come back. And he did, and they did, and I did. I told you, I left Coleman on January the 14th. I got back to Coleman about September the 14th. Not that I was in Hazelden all those years, but they didn't want me to come back during that school year. So I got sent to a halfway house. But that was great. I'm grateful for everything I got. But let me tell you, I got back to Coleman in September. I wish I could tell you I went to AA and everything was glory, hallelujah. I didn't. With all that money they've spent, all the learning I've had, Father Luke, God rest his soul, used to say to me, aren't you supposed to be going to some kind of meetings or something? I said, yeah, but they don't have them in Coleman. He said, well, surely they've got them in Decatur. That's only 30 miles away. You'd go up there. I said, well, I don't need them. I read the big book and I share my experience, strength, and help with people I think will do them some good. And I stayed a loner from that September until the January. So one day I didn't get back in the bottle. But one day that same Father Luke came to me and he said, here's a phone number. For your information, AA is alive and well in Coleman. I can't find it. He's not even an alcoholic. He's got the number. 3 days in a row, he said to me, did you call? I said, yes, they don't answer. Then he asked the right question. You know, you have to ask an alcoholic the right question. You want to get an answer. He says, when are you calling? I said, midnight. I'm not making that up. He says, pick up the telephone and call them now. And I called. And I got my first Coleman sponsor named Juby. And he answered the phone, and I said, Mr. Guthrie, this is Father Hillary out of the college. I'm an alcoholic, and I need to go to an AA meeting. There was this long silence, you know, on the phone. I thought he'd hung up. Finally, he says, and you'd have to understand a northern Alabama accent. He says, Father, are you drinking now? I said, no. He says, well, good. Don't take a drink. It so happens we got a meeting tonight at 8 o'clock. I'll be along at 7:30 to pick you up. I said, I don't need you to pick me up. Just tell me where the meeting is. I'll get there. You know, he's smart. He's read the big book, how to do with this business. Oh, no, he says, I'll pick you up at 7:30. You get ready. I said, well, that's fine, but don't come to the front door of the college. I'll meet you down on the road to the cemetery, under the tall pine trees in the dark of the moon. You know, so what he didn't say to me, hey, Father, when you want what we got and you willing to go to any lengths to get it, call me back. But he doesn't. And if you come to Coleman, I'll show you the road to the cemetery. I'll show you the tall pine trees. I'll show you the bushes that I crawled out of in the dark of the moon to go to my first meeting. And I wish I could tell you I walked up the steps and it was glory hallelujah. It wasn't. You should have seen it. Oh, it's improved. They still meet in the same place. Oh, it was up over the pool room. And there was a room, oh, about as big as one of those toilets over there. And the ceiling plaster was coming down. The wallpaper was rolling off the walls. There was the holes in the floor where they swept the dirt onto the people below. There was an old sofa with springs coming out of it. And there was about four people there, and they all looked like foot-washing Baptists at Church of Christ to me. Now, I don't want that to mean bad, but that was the way it was. And I looked through, there was a glass door, and I looked through that door, and I thought, oh, my Lord, am I going to be condemned to spend the rest of my life in this, with these people? And Juby, being a good sponsor, knew when to disappear. He was gone. I don't know where he was. But I knew I wasn't. It was a cold night in January. I wasn't going to walk the 2 miles back to the college. So while I'm standing there thinking all these thoughts and looking in that door, a lady comes up the steps. And she takes me by the arm. And she says, hello, Father Hillary. And I know her. She's a fine Catholic matron from Decatur. And she says, come on in. You're going to be all right. Let me get you a cup of coffee. You'll not have to drink any more. I didn't know she was an alcoholic. I knew that I had worked with her on church affairs many times, but I did not know that she was an alcoholic. And what I didn't know further was that she was a Sheola. That when I called Juby, he called up to Decatur. He says, Rosemary, come down here to Coleman this evening. I need you. She says, I can't. I'm chairing my own group. He says, no, you're not. You come down here. I got a Catholic priest coming in here tonight. I know the damn thing about Catholics, much less priests. You're a Catholic. You get down here and you help me with him. And when the poor, stupid, drunken Catholic priest is trying to get through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, there is Rosemary holding out the hand of AA. She mesmerized me right through the door. And I did not know for 2 years that that was a put-up deal. I did not know it. They wouldn't tell me till I was strong enough, they thought, to stand it. Then Rosemary came. Rosemary's still in the program. She's sick. She's not well. She can't go to many meetings. But believe me, I'll walk a long way for Rosemary. And I sometimes shudder to think what in my pride and arrogance would have happened to me if that woman hadn't been there that night to help me through the day. And that was the beginning. Oh, that was the beginning. I laughed at Susie the Souse tonight when they finally got her into AA. I could identify with that. Lord have mercy. We'd have closed meetings, discussion meetings. And I'd say things like this. Well, what I want to know is me, with my splendid aristocratic background, my superb college education. I've been to Harvard, I'll have you know. What in the hell am I doing? A drunk, an alcoholic. And there'd be that great silence that'd come over the group. You know, when everybody knows the answer, they're waiting to see who's going to zap the fool. And Juby would say, oh, hell, Father Hillary, it don't make no difference how the jackass got into the ditch. Just get him out. Isn't that glorious? The wisdom of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, Lord. And oh, so many, many things. But it was the beginning of the growing. It was the beginning of growing. And they only had one meeting a week. And it was a speaker's meeting. And they announced that night that they were going to have another meeting on Friday, and it would be a discussion meeting. And I said, well, that's fine. I don't like the speaker meetings anyway. I'll be glad to come to the study meeting, and one meeting enough a week will be fine for me. Well,
The old timer said, hey, if that big fat priest only comes once a week, he's going to be drunk again in short order. And so the group began to say, get Father Hillary to the meetings. Get Father Hillary to the meetings. They would say, anybody want to go to the meeting to Decatur tonight, just be down in front of the pool hall at 7 o'clock. There'll be a car, pick you up and take you up there. It was like the mafia. You know, these big cars would shoot up and the door would open in. You'd jump in and off they'd go, you know. And I wouldn't go. Wow. They'd say, we're going to Birmingham tomorrow night. Come on, go with us. Ah, no, I don't need it. We're going wherever. No, I wouldn't go. But they kept at me so long that finally I thought, well, you know, maybe I better go with them. Maybe I can help them. And I went. And then I was hooked. Man, we were traveling drunks in those years. Nowadays, they don't have to travel so much. We've got 10 or 12 meetings in Cullman. It's marvelous. But that was the beginning. And a sponsor, oh, Lord have mercy. I had two sponsors. One was the district attorney in the next county, who at that time had 30 years of sobriety. The other was a steel man who was retired, and he had about 25 years. And the two of them took one look at me and decided that I needed them. I never asked them to be my sponsor. In fact, I'd like to have got rid of them. But I didn't have enough nerve to tell them. And then I didn't know I could tell them. They didn't tell me that. Oh, Lord, you talk about it. They took me through the steps. I said, I've already been the first five. They said, no, we'll start again. Oh, Lord, have mercy. But I'm so grateful that they thought enough of me to. What a wonderful time. Well, I had been in, I guess, about 5 years or more, and the big boss retired. And I don't like to tell this, but my sponsor says it happened to you, and you're supposed to tell it, so tell it. When that happens, the monks get together and pray a lot, and they proceed to elect a new head honcho. There's no log rolling, no speech making. After they do all this praying, each monk is allowed to write out a nominating ballot. Who does he think would make maybe five or six? And my name was on that ballot, and I thought, oh, Lord have mercy, what, you know. And this is what they do. After they get the nominating ballot, they take the names in order, and they'd say, Father Adam, please leave the election hall. And Father Adam goes out, and then the president says, in God's holy name, what do you know about Father Adam that in your opinion will make him a good abbot, and in your opinion will make him a bad abbot? And then they start with the youngest monk, and everyone stands up and answers those questions. And they're funny, oh, Lord. You know, the young ones don't know any better, and they'll stand up and they'll say, well, I heard. And when they say that, they'll slam the fist down on things. Says, nobody's interested in what you heard. We ask what you know. And my name was called. I had to go out. I thought, oh, Lord, we'll be here all night by the time they finish that. But to make the long story short, in the morning when they took the ballot, the seventh abbot of St. Brendan was Abbot Hillary. That's what this gold chain and this ring is all about. The young monks aren't allowed to vote. You've got to be a 33rd degree member. But when they affect the election, they ring all the tower bells and the word goes out. You still have to stay in to sign all the papers. But the young monks hear that Father Hillary has been elected the seventh abbot. And they're running up and down the halls of the monastery shouting, all the way with AA. I can't begin to tell you what that says to me about the monks of St. Bernard, that they loved AA as much as I did. And they realized that if I was going to do the job that needed to be done, I would have to stay close to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they never, for 15 years, made it hard for me to stay in AA. Never. 15 years. I mean, if you've seen a Catholic bishop with his tall hat and his gold walking stick and all the lace and the red, I got all that. Yeah. in the Catholic Church, I'm a very important person. But be careful. The reason I tell you that is because my sponsor said, Father Hillary, let me tell you what that does. What that does is to say to AA people, you get in Alcoholics Anonymous and you get sober and you stay sober, there is nowhere you cannot go. There's nowhere you cannot go. Well, there's lots more things I could tell you. I'm going to tell you one more thing and then I'm going to shut up. I don't even know what time it is. Couldn't care less. There are two things from the big book I would call your attention to. One is on page 29. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. And that was true for me. My being an AA has made it so much more easy for me to be a Catholic. And the last thing, you know, is I was worried about, what about all the good times? Because I had some good times drinking. What about all the good times? They're all gone. Oh, Lord. And then somebody pointed out to me, page 132-33, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. We think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. We are sure that God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. Lord have mercy. And I have found that to be true. I would say if you think you had good times drinking, just go on and get into AA and come to Monterey. You know, I mean, I'm a priest, and I told you that. I'm a retired abbot. I'm very important. You should have seen me yesterday down at the aquarium. Three good-looking women. I would no more have done that when I was drinking than fly. But I knew we were perfectly safe. And it was, if it bothered anybody, it was their problem. Again, at noon today, three good-looking women had a wonderful time. You know? Oh, Lord. Well, here's the last story. Some years after I was in the program, I was abbot, and I had the occasion to go with some very important people like myself on a tour of the Holy Land to walk in the footsteps of Jesus. I didn't have much money, but they were kind to me. Those abbots had lots of money. They had oil wells and, oh, Lord, Oklahoma. Oh. Anyway, they took me with them, and I had a grand time. But everywhere as we went, we went to Bethlehem, we went to Calvary. All I could do was sit down and weep. And the bishops and the abbots would say to me, Abbot Hillary, stop that. What's wrong with you? And I would say, just get out of my way. AA has told me that when I want to weep, I can weep. I do not know today whether those were tears of making amends for the many times that I functioned as a priest when I shouldn't have, or whether they were the gift of tears, very ancient thing that the church writes about. I don't know. But I do know that it was all right. That all I could do was sit there and weep. But the place that impressed me the most in the Holy Land was Bethany, the home of Martha and Mary and Lazarus. If you read the Bible, they were great friends of Jesus's. And when things would get right up here with him, it looks like he'd go down there and spend a weekend. And Lazarus is sick, and the Lord's away preaching. And the apostles tell him, your friend Lazarus is real sick. We ought to go do something for him. And the Lord doesn't go. And Martha and Mary have been looking for him, you know. That hotshot rabbi has been doing so much about him. He's eating us out of house and home. Why don't you come over here and do something? And he doesn't. He doesn't even get there in time for the funeral. Read the Bible and see. But after he's dead, he goes. And Martha has been looking for him. She's been looking down the road. And she sees him coming, and she hot puts it out to confront him. And she does. And you have to hear the sarcasm in her voice when she says, Lord,
If thou hadst been here, my brother had not died.
That Martha, she was a good candidate for Al-Anon, I think. She doesn't realize that she's facing almighty power. She nearly tore the sheet. But she's also facing infinite mercy and love. And the Lord looks at her and he says, Martha, thy brother will live again. And all of a sudden, Martha is changed. All of a sudden, Martha has begun to read the big book. And she says, I know, Lord, I know. At the last day. And then Jesus goes in to see all the relatives and he says, want to go out and see the cemetery? Then they go out to see the cemetery. And he says, roll the stone back from the door of the tomb. And Martha, ever practical, says, Lord, he's been in there 4 days and the temperature has been over 100. By this time, he stinks. Ladies and gentlemen, I certainly did stink, but I surely do know what Lazarus felt like when he walked out of that tomb. Thank you so much for listening to me.